All right, well, grab your Bibles and open them up to 1 Samuel chapter 25. We are continuing today in the study that we've been doing, Crowns, study of leadership in ancient Israel that gives us a lesson of how God interacts with and leads his people in the world. Now, last week I explained that kind of the section that we're in are these three chapter sections where the two outside stories are part of the larger narrative that we've been going through, and they kind of sandwich this little vignette or this smaller story. And so last week we looked at that bigger story. We did two chapters, and we saw this story of David sparing Saul's life. David refusing to retaliate when Saul deserved to be killed. Right? Everything that you see in those chapters, Saul has it coming. He deserves to die, and yet David spares him. And David's reason for acting this way, he states this in 1 Samuel 26. He says, "As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down, into battle and perish." Which is David's way of saying, God's going to take care of it. Right? Saul will be punished. It'll be taken care of. David's job is to remain faithful. Now, step back from that, we go, that sounds really good, really holy, very Christian-y. But that's really hard to apply, especially to someone who is trying to kill you. And I'll say this, even if we can go chapter 24, I understand, right? David's very hopeful. It's almost impossible to justify that response in chapter 26 when Saul has gone back on his word, gone back out to hunt David, right? Is trying to get him. David's response seems almost inhuman. So last week we looked at the ethics of this. Basically, you should live this way. We saw David as an example for us. Today we're going to answer the question, how do you get here? How do we develop the character to respond this way? And we're going to answer that question through the story of how God developed this in David. We're going to look at how God worked in David's life to develop this response in him, which will help us not only to see David, but also to understand how God works in our lives today. So let's get into it. 1 Samuel chapter 25, starting in verse 1, it says this, "Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran." All right, the reason why this is significant is, well, we're in the book of 1 Samuel, so obviously he's a major character. But as we've said as we go along, Samuel's job is to kind of help us to understand what good is, what right is, what God's truth is. He was the one who provided a contrast to Eli's evil sons. He was the voice of reason to Saul when Saul kept doing stupid things. We know that Saul was wrong. We know that Saul was rejected by God because of Samuel. Samuel then is the one who anointed David, who confirmed that David was God's choice. And so without Samuel, how are we going to know what God wants? Right? As we continue in the story, how are we going to know what's right, what's wrong? How's God going to prepare his future king without the guy, the prophet, the one who he's been working through? Well, let's see. That's what we're here to figure out. Verse 2 says this, "There was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and his wife was Abigail. And the woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, so David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, 'Go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him, peace be to you and peace be to your house and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us and we did them no harm and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men and they will tell you. Therefore let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David.'" All right, so what's going on here? Well, we're introduced to two new characters, and these characters are going to play a major role as this chapter goes on. The two characters are Nabal and Abigail. They're introduced to us very differently. Right, Nabal, which by the way is the Hebrew word for fool, fits very well with where we're going. He's introduced to us by his possessions. Right, we basically go, here's Nabal, and this is how you know him. He's rich, he has lots of sheep and lots of goats. Only then does it give us any description of him as a person, and that is not a good description. The description that we get of Nabal is that he was harsh and badly behaved. And then you have this little aside, he was a Calebite, which means nothing to us, but apparently to them cleared it all up. Like, he's a Calebite, right? So that's who this guy is. Bad dude, wrong side of the tracks, nobody likes him, as we will see as we go on. And then we have his wife, Abigail, who is described very differently. Abigail, it says, is discerning and beautiful. And that beauty, if you get into the Hebrew, isn't just physical beauty. It means that she was a beautiful person. Now, the relationship with Nabal and Abigail had been initiated by David. And the reason why there's any interaction is because when David was up in the wilderness with his men, they befriended Nabal's shepherds. Now, why they decided to do this, we don't know. Maybe David still has a soft spot in his heart for shepherds because of his time as a shepherd. Maybe it was just the right thing to do. But as he was in the wilderness, he saw all these sheep, all these goats, and the shepherds out there, and he decided that he and his men were going to protect these flocks. And that was a necessary thing. Because if you're a shepherd out in the wilderness, you basically open yourself up to raiding parties. So basically, you're out there, there's three or four of you and all these sheep and goats, and a band of 10 warriors wants to come and take some sheep from you, you have no defense, right? A little shepherd's crook's only going to do so much. But if you have a David's warrior men around you, all of a sudden you're protected. And so with David's protection, the flocks were safe. The story goes on, it comes to shearing time, right? So this is the part where they're actually going to reap the harvest of what sheep do. And Nabal has come out to oversee the process. So Nabal is out and he's present. But what this also means is this is the opportunity for Nabal to see how well his flocks have been protected. Because he would be used to coming out and seeing his flocks come in, you know, having been picked off a little bit. Now he gets to come in and see, wow, they're all here. All of my flocks have returned. And so David sends some men to basically kind of speak to him as he's there. And David sends his men to basically say, we protected you, now please throw us a thank you party. Now, to be clear, David's men are hungry. They're living in the wilderness. They're spending their time protecting Nabal's flocks, but there's only so much food in the wilderness, which actually shows how far they were going and how much they were sacrificing. They could have been the raiders who took Nabal's sheep. But they're not only not taking those to eat, they're protecting. And so they have been doing a service for Nabal. And so David sends 10 men to confront him. Say, hey, this is what we've been doing. How about a little bit something back? Now we get to see Nabal's response. Verse 9, this is what he says. It says, when David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shears and give it to men who have come from I don't know where? So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this. And David said to his men, every man strap on a sword. And every man of them strapped on his sword. And David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. This escalated quickly. Right? Simply put, David's men present the case, right? We helped you, now help us. And Nabal says, no, no. And so David calls his men to suit up for battle. Now, before we move on, there's something to be noticed in the way that Nabal responds to David or David's men, because it shows some common characteristics, some ways that people often respond to news they don't like. And it helps to recognize this because we all interact with people. Some of you are a little bit more introverted than others, but all of you interact with people on some basis, and it's helpful to understand certain responses when you see them. Partially just so you know what's going on, and partially because it's your responsibility to respond well, not be reactive, and this helps. So in Nabal's response, we see three things in the way that he reacts. The first one is dismissing, the second one is character assassination, and the third one is defensiveness. So let's look at these because, again, they're helpful to for us to understand some common ways that people respond. First one, dismissing. Nabal says, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? Now, these questions are an attempt to undercut David's proposal. It isn't because he doesn't know who David is, but the way he asked the questions here is a way of just basically saying, I don't need to listen to David. It's a way of saying, who does he think he is? He has no right to ask anything of me. This is an initial reaction many people have when faced with confrontation. You have no authority over me, mind your own business, judge not lest ye be judged, you know, spec plank, all these sorts of things. The reason people respond this way, the reason why they do this, is because you never have to deal with the actual issue if you kind of lash out at the person bringing the comment in the first place. This is merely a distraction. The issue now goes from being whatever it was in the beginning to being the worthiness of the speaker. Which leads to the second tactic, character assassination. Here's what Nabal says. He says, there are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. He's making a comment there about the fact that David and Saul aren't on the same page, which shows us that Nabal may be a fool, but he isn't stupid. He's attacking David's credibility by painting him as an unfaithful servant of the king. It's not just then I owe David nothing. It's actually, David, you're the problem. I'm not the problem. You're the problem. Right? David, you're not to be trusted. Now, once again, this is a very natural reaction to confrontation, right? Right? You bring somebody to someone like, well, what about you? And what that does is it puts the onus back on the speaker, right, to defend themselves. It sidetracks the conversation to another topic altogether. There's another way to do this as well. Nabal does all three. He's actually pretty thorough here. Third tactic, third way to kind of distract the conversation is defensiveness. What Nabal says is this, shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shears and give it to the men who come from I do not know where? I mean, just read that sentence. My bread, my water, my meat, my shears. There's a guy who is described by his possessions. Nabal cannot see beyond mine. He does not for 1 minute consider what may have been if David's men weren't there to protect his sheep. His entire worldview is based on what is being taken from him right here, right now. And so he sets up a defensive position and basically makes David the attacker, the one who is coming to take something from him. He is the victim being robbed from. And it almost works. And what I mean by that is, the first time I read this account, I thought, David doesn't really have a right to demand anything from this guy, does he? I mean, the guy's a jerk, obviously, but like, does he have a point? Nabal didn't ask David to protect his sheep. They didn't have a contract, for all I know. So I'm going, okay, so David does seem to kind of be overstepping his bounds here a little bit. Then I went back and actually read what David said. Here's what David said. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David. Which is to say, he's not going in there demanding all sorts of things. He's basically saying, we have shown kindness to you. Please show kindness to us. He's appealing to common courtesy. And as I read this, I realized, and I was reminded that conversations can be flipped very quickly. Things can be turned against you like this very quickly. And I say this because I've been in this situation numerous times. I've been in plenty of situations where I go in and I'm like, okay, this is what we're going to talk about or have a meeting. And then like 5 minutes into the meeting, I'm like, why are we not talking about what I thought we came to talk about? Why are we talking about my worthiness? Why am I being challenged to defend myself? Why am I being addressed as an attacker? What is going on here? And I've had to walk numerous people in this church. You know who I'm talking about, right? You know who you are. Had to walk numerous people through this same process. I don't even know what happened. I went in there and I thought this was what was going to happen. And then I came out and basically I had promised them all sorts of things. And what happened? If you're not careful, this sort of thing will create one of two unhealthy responses. First possibility is simply that you will be manipulated. You will walk out questioning whether you had the right to speak, feeling like you did this person a disservice, vowing to never enter into a situation like that ever again with anyone. In this, your view of yourself gets created and shaped by the distorted view of another person. And you end up shying away from true relationship with anyone because of it. I would say that a lot of our culture's inability to disagree well, to actually just sit down and be like, hey, we don't agree. Okay, well, let's disagree, comes from people interacting with badly behaved people like Nabal. Which also creates another unhealthy response, which is one we see quite often in our culture, and that is you'll get mad. You'll get aggressive and defensive yourself. When someone puts you on your heels and treats you as the opposition, it's very easy to take on the role they're already casting on you. Oh, a fight is what you want. Well, that's what David does. Right? David goes, get your swords. We're going to battle. But there's another response. An actually healthy response. Do you know that? As human beings, we are capable of healthy responses. And we get to see that healthy response in the story here through the character of Abigail. So let's just go. We'll see what she does. Verse 14. Here's what it says. We got a big old section to read. It says, but one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything while we were in the fields, so as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us, both by day and by night, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore, know this and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all this house, and he is such a worthless man and that one cannot speak to him. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 seahs of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, go on before me, behold, I come after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. And as she rode on the donkey and came down under the cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her and she met them. Now David had said, surely in vain have I guarded all that fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, on me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord... So there's a lot of Lord in here. You got to go between the capitalized and the not capitalized. Okay. For the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you as long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause or for my Lord working salvation himself. And when the Lord has dealt with my Lord, then remember your servant. All right. All right, so Abigail is approached by one of the servants, one of the shepherds that had been out in the fields, and the situation is laid out before her. He basically goes, here's what happened. David's men came down. This is what they said. Your idiot husband, this is what he did. But they were good. These men did good things. And he makes it very clear, the reason I'm coming to you and not to him is because he is a worthless fellow and you cannot speak to him. So Abigail hears about what is going on, and her first response is to jump to action. Something needs to be done. So she prepares a peace offering for David, and she sets out to meet him before he attacks. So she cuts David off along the way, and it tells us before she gets there, David is mad. David is ready to go. He is going to annihilate their entire village. And so she approaches. She gets off of her donkey, and she falls on her face before him and honors him as the future king. That's why she keeps saying Lord. She's responding to him in respect. She's basically the anti-Nabal. He showed no honor, no respect, and she is coming and saying, you deserve respect even in the position that you have not quite reached. And then she makes four requests of David. Four things she asks of him. The first one is, she says, please ignore Nabal. Do not take his words, his accusations to heart. The reason he sounds like a fool is because he is. And she keeps going, see his name? His parents named him well. Are you really going to feel good about defeating a fool for being a fool? Basically, what she's saying is when a person treats you like this, it's much more about them than it is about you. You don't have to take every accusation thrown your way as an attack on you. When someone attacks you and makes you an enemy simply so they can win, the correct posture towards them is pity. Because a person who lives their lives like that has messed up relationships all over the place. Look at Nabal. His wife doesn't respect him. His men don't respect him. I'm guessing his life is just a bunch of people who are like, okay, yeah, that guy. Imagine what it's like to live like that. You don't have to attack a person who's in that position. Actually, it's a place for us to show them a certain sort of love and care that they're not getting from anywhere else. Other people are not willing to put up with someone like that. Second thing she requests, she says, let God be justice. Now, what's interesting is that is David's comment from chapter 26. We now see where he got the perspective that he had later on. She says, you don't need this on your conscience. A guy like Nabal, he's going to get himself killed. Somebody will finish him off. It doesn't have to be you. Right? You don't need that blood on your hands. You don't need to go on and be king and be thinking back to that time. Oh man, I can't believe when I went to that village and killed them all. Right? You don't need that. God will take care of it. In the same way, when someone responds to us in this way, the best thing we can do is stay faithful. Their colors will show. God will take care of it. Stooping to their level keeps us from growing in maturity and being a faithful witness to those around us. We ruin what God has given us to do. Third thing she says is take the peace offering. Now, we won't go through all the things that she brought, but basically for 600 men, this was a very small meal. You can see them like slicing the bean like in the old Mickey Mouse cartoon. Right? I mean, like, this is not going to go very far, but it's the thought that counts. She brought all that she had as a thank you. Basically, she's showing honor in it. And I'd say that the correlation for us is that when you act faithfully, you will sometimes confront the nabals of this world, but there's always, always good that comes from the situation. It's not always to the level that you want or expect, and sometimes, man, it's hard to find, but there's always a gift in the midst, and we have the choice to accept or reject that based on what we feel we deserve. And accepting the good that God gives us, even when it's not what we expected, is how he changes us, is how he matures us, is how he brings us in line with who he is. We have the choice to be thankful or be obsessed with injustice. Fourth thing she does is she asks forgiveness. And the forgiveness she requests is based on what God will do. Right? Again, she says, you will be king over this nation. God has already said he will vindicate you. This is not going to help you get there. Right? If you think about where you're going, this is just going to get in the way. And so the motivation for forgiveness is not Nabal deserving it. The motivation for forgiveness is the greater purpose that God has laid out. And it's this forward thinking that puts the present into perspective. In other words, if you have a great future out ahead of you, why would you do anything right now to jeopardize it? Why carry the shame and guilt of mistakes into victory? This is what she's saying when she says, "My Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord working salvation himself." It's a great phrase. You know, she's saying, David, you don't want to try to work salvation yourself. It's going to go poorly. Now, let's think about what that means for us, right? Because Christians have been promised a future glory. We have been promised a perfect justice. We have been told that one day all things will be remade. Christ will be present in glory, and we will be ruling with him. And the weight of all of that is on God. He will do all those things. He will make all those things come to pass. He will surely do it. Now, does that mean we sit back and go, okay, we got nothing to do then? No, of course not. But our part is to be faithful. Allow God to use our faithfulness to do whatever he's doing rather than going, yeah, God, I see what you're saying here, but that doesn't work. I'm just going to do this because that seems to be more profitable in this world that we live in. I'm going to work salvation myself. But when we try to work salvation ourselves, Abigail calls out David for here, we tend to create more and more and more of a mess to clean up. Our solutions create more problems. And we become something other than what we are meant to be. David recognizes this. He recognizes what Abigail saved him from. And he thanks her. Here's what he says in verse 32. It says, "And David said to Abigail, 'Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male.' Then David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, 'Go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice, and I have granted your petition.'" So David admits that if Abigail had not stopped him, he would have made a horrible mistake. If she had not confronted him with the truth, he would have acted badly. He would have become like Nabal. He would have been the fool. And so he sees that salvation. He praises God for sending her. He sees Abigail and her faith as a gift from God. And in this, we see why we can't just shy away from confrontation. Why, as Christians, we can't buy into the live and let live, man. I don't want to deal with the Nabals of this world, so I'm just going to sit back, and I'm going to do my own thing, and I'm going to let everyone else do their own thing. Because God uses people to do his work. If Abigail had not confronted David, she'd be dead. It's through people that God does the work of sanctification. It's through iron sharpening iron that we grow in faithful maturity, which is an important shift to make. So if asked what the most important part of Christian living is, most people would say something about love, service, acts of mercy, right? Some sort of thing that we do. But when we read the Bible, we see that all of those things, all of those acts, are byproducts of a much bigger purpose, right? We do those things because we have been sanctified, transformed by the renewal of your mind, conformed to the image of Jesus. The idea is that our goal on this earth is to become more and more dependent on God, and through that complete dependence on Him, we will be a conduit of His love and power. Ultimately, that's the example that Jesus was. Jesus was perfectly obedient. That's why He was able to perfectly act out God's will. Basically, we are most effective when we trust Him to work. And if we get caught up in the game of fools, we either set aside truth for the sake of peace, right, becoming something we regret, or we take up arms and attack, becoming something else we will regret. It's only through trusting God to work through faithfulness that we don't compromise our faith. But it's more than that. As I said in the intro, this chapter is why David responds the way he does in chapter 26. Right? The reason why David is able to set aside his frustration towards Saul is because he learned this lesson. Because he was changed. David's natural reaction is not peace. He's a warrior. This had to be developed in him. And so in this story, we see that David is built up as a leader through Nabal and through Abigail. And I say through both of them because without the fool, Abigail doesn't get to act and show him truth. And what this means for all of us is that every interaction in this life, every situation, God uses to discipline us. Now, that word discipline is a little tough. I don't mean that God uses every situation in this life to spank us down, to beat us up, right? Just to go, just remember, I'm God. No, the discipline that we're talking about there is like working out, right? You discipline your body. Paul talks about that. It's maturing us. It's growing us, and growing us takes some work. This world is a training ground for us. It's preparing us for leadership. God is making us more than we were if we actually enter into this. Now, when I say leader, I don't mean like positions of leadership necessarily. In this story, the person who exemplifies leadership, who exemplifies and who does lead, is actually the person with the least amount of earthly power in the whole story. Well, the two people, actually, because you got the servant and you got Abigail. But Abigail, while she might not have position, has maturity. Where does that maturity come from? Well, most likely it came from the fact that she was in a crappy marriage. She had to mature. Look who she's married to. And God used that difficult situation to grow her, to be wise, discerning, and faithful, to put her in a place where she now shifts the entire nation of Israel. She's the voice of wisdom to train the future king. And I would say in all of this, when we read stories like this, it should draw us to a point where we realize that we have no idea of how God can and will use us. We have no idea what this current situation that we're in, good, bad, neutral, what that's going to lead to. But the idea of trusting God is that we don't have to. Right, rather than lamenting the fact that life feels quite unfair and out of control, we can actually be thankful in the midst of it, knowing that God is using all things to shape His people, to prepare them, to grow them. To grow them to what? People that He will use to fulfill all of the aspects of His plan that He has laid out. Now, the nice thing about the Old Testament stories is a lot of times the completion is real short. They don't have to wait till eternity. It happens a chapter later or a couple verses later. Like here, verse 36. So look at how the story ends. It says, "And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. And in the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, 'Blessed be the Lord who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal and has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head.' Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. And when the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, 'David has sent us to take you to him as his wife.' And she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, 'Behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord.' And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her 5 young women attended her. And she followed the messengers of David and became his wife. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was of Galim." All right, so Abigail waits until Nabal sobers up, because really, what's the point of talking to him when he's drunk? He's a fool when he's sober. And so basically she tells him what she did. She said, "I went behind your back. I basically let you lose this battle by submitting myself to the future king. I saved your life, by the way." And it says, he became as a stone. Which I don't really know what that means. But then it says, God strikes him dead 10 days later. And so, I'll be honest, there are people who try to describe medically what's happening here. I have no idea. Right? But what we do know is that God's justice was revealed against Nabal. Right? Justice was served. Then says that David sends for Abigail and she becomes his wife. This is not David's first wife. It won't be his last wife. That is something I will address in a blog post this week, because that is a whole other avenue I don't want to get into right now. But we will address that. I'm not just going to ignore the elephant in the room. But what I want to focus on here instead to finish up today is the more metaphorical picture of what is happening. Right? Nabal gets justice, David gets blessed. While in the moment, David is hungry, and Nabal is affluent and in control. Right? The whole story, Nabal's been in the point of power and wealth. David is running around the wilderness with his men, hungry, without a place to call a home. And yet we know it's not always going to be like that. In the same way, as Christians, we're called to live above our position, toward a greater future, to not get caught up in the petty struggles of the present. Now, this doesn't mean we don't live in the present, that we continually downplay what is happening around us, but what it means is we actually can act boldly, boldly in the present, toward a promised future. We should be striving to stir one another up, encouraging, building, challenging, maturing, living in the hope of Jesus Christ. Doing things that don't feel like the most important thing right now, but are the most important thing when we actually look at what eternity means. Because we measure the effectiveness of these acts in eternity. It's one of the reasons why we come here every week. Because everything about life is about, all right, schedule, what do we got? I wake up at 6:30, I got breakfast, I got the kids out the door, right? It's like, man, it's right in front of you all the time. Every once in a while, we need to step back and take the bigger view. And when we come here every Sunday, we have the opportunity to take communion, the shed body and blood of Christ. And when we do that, what we're doing is we're asking him to connect us to the power behind the faithfulness, the victory behind the death, the joy behind the struggle, that thing that we know is real but that we don't feel on a daily basis. When Jesus gave the sacrament of communion to his disciples at the Last Supper, he said this. He said, "For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." What does that mean? We proclaim his death. Seems kind of morbid, right? Hey, Christians, we're here to celebrate death. Well, it means we connect ourselves to the paradox of the cross. Jesus died to give life. It reminds us that what we experience on this level is only part of the story. It doesn't make it not real, but it's not the whole thing. So we proclaim this until he comes, which is to say, we hold tightly to the truth of what is, while we wait for him to reveal that depth that we right now cannot see. So this morning, come to the table, asking Jesus to help you mature in the faith, asking him to grow you through whatever means possible, through whatever situations you're currently living in. Make us strong so that we can persevere. Help us to hold tight to the truth we don't always feel. Carry us through. Let's pray.